from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Charlie Parker came up out of Kansas City, lived a short life, and left a revolutionary mark on jazz. Bebop is one way to put it. The great jazz critic Stanley Crouch has a whole lot more ways to put it. Charlie Parker as a man who could create a new experience of time, he says, was singular. This hour On Point, Stanley Crouch on Charlie Parker on Bird. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What is it, was it, about Bird? Charlie Parker. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Stanley Crouch, poet, novelist, biographer, jazz man, jazz writer, big cultural critic, his own big footprints all over in Don't the Moon Look Lonesome, The All-American Skin Game, and Considering Genius. A MacArthur genius himself, co-founder of Jazz at Lincoln Center in New York, he spent a famous 30 years working on the life of Charlie Parker. Now, Volume 1, The Early Years, is out. It's called Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. Stanley Crouch, welcome back to On Point. It is so good to have you. Thank you very much for being here.
It's so good to be here.
Listen, I just love this. This is just, never mind the music. Mind the music, but your handle on this is just so wonderful and multifarious, and I know you've put decades into it. 30 years ago, when you started talking with the people who knew Charlie Parker so well, what were you setting out to do, Stanley Crouch?
Well, I was not setting out to do what I ended up doing at the beginning, but I've just gotten a book put out by the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York, and it's titled Art Is. And when I look through it, it makes me think of myself writing this book, because every subject that I came to incorporate into the narrative of Charlie Parker's life, I knew he knew about them. And so I had to figure out how they actually came into his life. And so that meant I had to study American film. I had to study newsreels. I had to study American history. I had to study, of course, what was happening in jazz in Kansas City when he was coming up, and so on. So that the reason it took so long to do was because I had to know so many things that I could make them seem natural, because they were natural during the time that Charlie Parker was alive. It's something like if someone were to write a book today or 50 years from now about someone who grew up in this digital era, they would have to be able to make all of the machinery that has come into being and is part of modern life seem natural to the guy.
Yeah.
Or to the woman. It doesn't make any difference which one.
And oh boy, you take us back here in such a big, deep, kind of impressionistic but very hard tack way at the same time. And Dwight Garner says, New York Times, the ideal way to ingest Stanley Crouch's new book is probably on audio, late at night, while driving between the major cities of the Midwest, your headlights pushing past truck stops and dying cornfields. Just let it flow over you. You really have immersed yourself in it.
Well, I felt that was the only way I could deliver the period, because what I most wanted to do was make the reader feel that he or she was there, and that the things that Charlie Parker saw and the things that were happening around him were right in front of them. They were not behind them. They were not to the side. They were right in front of them. And so it took a long time to learn how to do that.
Take us there. Let's put on a little Charlie Parker here. This is Body and Soul. There are not many recordings of his music in the early years you're writing about here. This is Body and Soul, 1940. This is at the Trocadero Ballroom in Wichita, Kansas. Charlie Parker on saxophone, of course, just 21 years old, with pianist Jay McShann and his orchestra, playing the jazz standard Body and Soul. right, Stanley Crouch, take us there. Trocadero Ballroom, Wichita, Kansas, 1940. What do we see? What do we feel? What's around us?
Well, the thing is that we feel the time that was going on, that is, was before the war. It was, we were coming out of the Depression, or the Depression was doomed because the war was going to doom Depression finally. And Charlie Parker had begun to actually master the saxophone in the way that he wanted to master it. That is, to make melodic statements, improvised on the moment, and to finally be able to hear clearly the drummer, the bass, and the piano, and of course the other instruments that would of course be playing around him. And so his major job was to learn how to hear like all musicians have to do. And he became a vastly gifted and masterful musician at hearing clearly. And that's the major achievement of jazz playing, as far as I can tell.
You put us right in the middle of that. I'd love to hear some just from the beginning, not the prologue, but the book where you've got Charlie Parker and the musicians with him. It's a Sunday morning in December. They're in Des Moines, Iowa, sitting on the curb. They're on tour. I would love it if you'd read some of that from Kansas City Lightning, Stanley Crouch.
Okay. For these, for Kansas City, for these men and many others, was home base. For years, it had been a wide-open city, thanks to the power of local gangsters and the corruption of boss Tom Pendergast's regime. And in that time, the city had become a hotbed of thrilling bandstand creativity. By 1941, however, Pendergast had been fitted for a prison suit, and the vibrant glare of KC nightlife was in decline. Now the music was starting to drift away from the city, flowing west, north, and east with the musicians. These musicians had known no depression in Kansas City, no lack of work. Throughout the late 1920s and the 30s, they had been free to play, compete, and party around the clock. In that boom town for jazz, motherlodes of style and gushes of swing were mined and brought in, if not nightly, then with enough consistency to make way for a newly textured pressure on the rhythm, a southwestern swing that celebrated the soul as well as the coos, the calls, the cries, and the lamentations of the flesh in pulsive time.
Stanley Crouch reading from Kansas City Lightning, and they would take it soon to New York. Let's hear a little of that. Hootie Blues. Early 1940s with Jay McShand and his orchestra at New York's Savoy Ballroom. Stanley Crouch, what was the Kansas City handle on blues? We can hear it working right there. Describe it for us.
Well, the guys in Kansas City, what they had figured out was, as one guy said to me long ago, he said, they swung the blues. The blues to them was not only in a slow tempo. It could be slow. It could be medium fast. It could be fast. They knew that you could feel the blues at any tempo. And so they played like that. And Charlie Parker was an early master of stating the feeling of the blues, which is basically a bittersweet feeling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's about life, but it's not about life always being sad or always being happy. It's somewhere in between there. And the blues seems to weave its way through human experience so that at the worst time in a blues lyric, you can hear a melody being played behind the blues by one of the horn players,
mm-hmm.
and the melody will actually be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Or the melody will make fun of what the blues singer is singing. And then suddenly the blues singer might turn around and say something in a way that, like, responds to the horns and say, oh, basically, well, yes, I think that was terrible, but right, it wasn't that bad.
It's a conversation, a great conversation. Stanley Crouch writes about the early years of the life of Charlie Parker, Bird, in his big new wonderful book, Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. Stanley Crouch, please stand by in New York. We've got lots of great music coming here. We'll hear Charlie Parker dance around a little behind Sarah Vaughan before we're finished, and a whole lot more. Listeners, you can join us. Do you know Bird? Charlie Parker, sax man, the artist of Ornithology, Yardbird Suite, Warming Up a Riff, and so much more. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Bird, jazz great Charlie Parker, and his rise out of Kansas City to fame, magic, bebop, with famed jazz writer and cultural critic Stanley Crouch. His big new book on Charlie Parker's early years is Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. You can join us. Do you know Bird, the artist of Ornithology and Yardbird Suite, the jazz interpreter of Embraceable You, How Deep is the Ocean, My Old Flame? What's your take? What made Bird, Bird? What made the man, what made his music, his jazz, unique? And are you ready to see a whole era in American history through Bird? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Behind us right here, Cherokee, 1942, Clark Monroe's Uptown House in New York. Yes, they made it there. Dwight Garner writes that Stanley Crouch's book is a 365-page riff on Charlie Parker, on America in the first half of the 20th century, and on black intellect and feeling. Stanley Crouch joins us from New York. What was the Kansas City take on black intellect and feeling? What was the crucible that was shaping Charlie Parker in those terms, Stanley? What made it different?
Well, I don't really agree with that way of saying it. What I mean is, the guys knew that they were black and they were not white, but they didn't. They only partially knew that because part of the book is often about the fact that, as Ralph Ellison loved to say, we're all part of something else. So Charlie Parker was part Indian, he was part African, he was part European. Mm-hmm. He had all of those mixtures in his bloodstream. And so he was an example of what many Americans happen to be, and many black Americans knew then that they basically had a cosmopolitan bloodline. Mm-hmm. So what I mean is, they didn't deny that they had African blood in them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they also didn't deny if they had Indian blood in them. And if they had Irish blood in them, they would say that too. And so when I would be talking to different people from that era, they tended to display or talk about the many people that were in them. It's like that song that Abby Lincoln did called People in Me, right?
Yeah.
And she talks about, I got some African, I got some this, I got some that, I got some that. Now, certain people would think that's pretentious or absurd or an attempt to evade one's actual ethnic identity. But one's actual ethnic identity is multi-layered. And the people during Charlie Parker's era did not actually feel feel required to deny that they were a mixture of different people. And so there's even one part in the book where one guy, this trumpet player mm-hmm. who had played with Jelly Roll Morton, told me that once Hitler came to power and began to talk about the Third Reich is filled with people who comprised the master race, whenever they would play with somebody who was a light-skinned person, who would be kind of obnoxious, they would refer to them and say, okay, master race, we'll do that. Right. And so
and you're right in your place at that moment, right?
Right.
But there's a kind of freedom in that cosmopolitan bloodline you're describing, that sense of it. I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm a lot.
Right. And see, the thing is that, as far as I can tell, made the people feel that everything that happened in America that was good was partially theirs.
Yeah.
In other words, they didn't feel alienated from any flyers. They didn't feel alienated from any innovators in the sciences. They didn't feel alienated. They thought everything that was in America that was good and they could enhance your dreams about yourself or about other people, those were yours to live in terms of. And as Ralph Ellison loved to say, he said, well, we never did actually take seriously or live in terms of the stereotypes of us that came out of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't believe that. We knew we were something else, and we had our own dreams, and we had our own designs on life, and we lived in terms of that. And one of the things I try to do in the book is give the reader the feeling of being part of a vital culture and a vital group of people who are interplaying with everybody else that they're around. And there are people like Walter Bales, the wealthy guy who helped J. McShann put together his band that he took to New York with Charlie Parker in it.
Yeah.
And Walter Bales represents something that we don't really emphasize enough in American culture, which is that there have always been some among the wealthy who could sense the value of something that did not have a long tradition. So then when Walter Bales heard that J. McShann could play, Walter Bales also played the piano and they would get together. And he would talk with McShann and they would exchange ideas and they'd improvise together. And eventually they got Count Basie there. So these three pianos are playing together.
Count Basie, another big son of Kansas City there. What an incredible cluster of people.
Yeah, what I mean is...
Mm-hmm.
We can see that in the building of the Museum of Modern Art, in New York City Ballet. All of those things tended to come about because someone who was fortunate actually had a feeling for the art itself and could bring the art and put it in a place in New York for everybody to benefit from.
I want to get to New York, but take us to that Midwestern tour circuit first, if you would. I just love that piece that comes very early in the book, where they're setting out on the Balaban and Cats, you describe it. Could you read that for us? It's just wonderful, the terrain they covered. Before it really went big in New York, this was right down the middle of the country.
Yeah, okay. Well, here it comes. One Sunday morning, unseasonably warm in December, a group of musicians sat out front on the curb in front of a rooming house in Des Moines, Iowa. Des Moines was one of the stops on what was then known as the Balaban and Cats Circuit. If you were a musician in the 1930s, the circuits took you through different cities, different landscapes. The Balaban and Cats, for instance, took you out of Kansas City and up to Lincoln, Nebraska, then over to Des Moines, north to Minneapolis and St. Paul, back down through Madison, Wisconsin, over to Milwaukee, south to Chicago, then to Springfield, Illinois, moved on to St. Louis, rolled you into Jackson City, Missouri, and then back to Kansas City. You heard not just different music, but different language on the circuits, and saw different women along the way. It was an adventure, always, but the miles and the fatigue were worth it when you got out of those cars and stretched, spruced up if you had the time, sauntered into those halls, set up your instruments, fixed the wooden folding chairs in place, took out the music, tuned up, relaxed, and later unleashed the nappy-necked lightning of jazz, then you came alive in a very special way. Then glamour, grace, and audacity could rumble from your instruments. Then your mind could shine like Klondike gold.
Up and down the middle of the country, and then they took it with all the jam sessions and all the energy and all that kind of desperado, a little bit of the Western frontier, right into New York. It was 1943, Boogie Woogie. This is Billy Eckstine's jam session with Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker on tenor sax. Parker first. Stanley Crouch writes it all up, the early years in Kansas City Lightning. Introduce us to this particular man, young man, this particular musician. You described him as lean as a telephone wire at 127 pounds when he was touring on that Midwest circuit. By the time he got to this kind of performance in New York, and they were anxious to get there, who was Charlie Parker?
Well, by then, Charlie Parker had developed or a new way of playing the saxophone, a new way of phrasing, a new sound. His tone was very different than what was expected at the time. But he could play the saxophone so well that people, if they didn't like it at first, they came to like it because he could play with such authority. And that authority made his every feature on with the band an exciting moment because the band didn't know what he was going to play. He didn't know what he was going to play, and the audience definitely did not know what he was going to play.
What kind of family did he come up out of in Kansas City, Stanley Crouch?
Well, he came out of a lower-class family, but unlike the poor colored boy sitting on cotton bales, his mother actually dressed him in J.B. Simpson suits that were specially cut for him.
Spoiled him, you say. You're right.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. When his first wife met him, she couldn't believe he was there because she had never seen anybody dressed the way he was who didn't actually come from money but looked like he did.
Yeah, looking fine. I've got a little bit of Charlie Parker himself. This was much later in his life, near the end, because it ended too soon. This is 1954, John McClellan and Paul Desmond. This is WHDH in Boston. Interviewing Charlie Parker, they asked him if there was something special about his training as a young saxophonist in Kansas that led to his technique.
I can't see where there's anything fantastic about it at all. I put quite a bit of study into the horn, that's true. Mm-hmm. In fact, the neighbors threatened to ask my mother to move once when I was living out west. I mean, they said I was driving them crazy with the horn. I used to put in at least 11 to 15 hours a day.
11 to 15 hours a day, and then a little more, they asked him about New York. He was in his early 20s playing with Dizzy Gillespie.
There was nothing to do but play, you know, and we had a lot of fun trying to play, you know. I did. Mm-hmm. Plenty of jam sessions. Met much late hours. Plenty good food. Just nice, clean living, you know. Mm-hmm. But basically speaking, much poverty.
Yeah. That's always good, too. No worries.
It has its place, definitely, in life.
Charlie Parker, Bird, Stanley Crouch, writes it all up in Kansas City Lightning. He's downplaying Kansas City right there in that interview, Stanley Crouch. But what about it? I'm still looking for that special thing. I mean, you say that when he showed up in New York, first of all, they were ready to rumble. They weren't afraid. They were ready to make their mark in this town, and they really did.
Yeah, well, see, they did. They were Kansas City musicians. And Kansas City musicians loved to step on famous New York musicians who came to Kansas City and made the mistake of coming to one of their jam sessions or getting up on the bandstand with them, because they would then box their ears and send them back wishing they had never played in Kansas City at all. That was one of their favorite things to do. And so there was that, but there were also people who influenced Charlie Parker who came in there, like True Berry, and he put something down that was so heavy, everybody in the jam session started walking out the door, and Charlie Parker's mentor of the time, Buster Smith, a great saxophonist, stood up and laughed at these guys, and he said, "I told you all not to mess with that man."
Yeah.
So Lester Young and these guys, they were ready to jump True Berry until they heard him start playing. And they realized they didn't want any of that. And what I mean is, there was this feeling always in Kansas City, if you come here to play, if you get up on the bandstand, you better be playing.
Throw down.
Yeah, because if you're not playing, you're going to find out your hands will get stepped on, your neck will get stepped on, your head will get stepped on.
And they listened and everybody knew it. Don's calling from Buffalo, New York. Don, you're on the air with Stanley Crouch.
Hello, Tom. There was a famous nightclub in New York called Birdland. Uh-huh. And I was wondering if you could comment on that a little bit.
Well, it goes right to Charlie Parker. Stanley Crouch?
Oh, well, it was named after Charlie Parker, and he played there many times. And he was at one time barred from the club, but he played there many times, and it was named after him. And it was very famous for this guy who wasn't a guy, but they thought he was a guy, named Pee Wee Marquette, who used to introduce the bands. And he would charge you money to introduce you, or he would get up and he would mess up your name on the microphone. So it was famous about that.
Barred from the club. I mean, it was Miles Davis talked about how it wasn't necessarily an easy thing to play with Charlie Parker. Drugs would come in. You weren't exactly sure how Charlie would roll.
Well, the thing is, he was unpredictable, but far and away, most of the time, he played better than everybody else played. And Dizzy Gillespie made that very clear to me. He said, "I only heard Charlie Parker 4 or 5 times when he wasn't high." He said, "Now, he could always play better than everybody else, but people say that he discouraged some people from playing the saxophone or from playing music at all. Had they ever heard him when he wasn't high, he would have discouraged more of those people."
Stanley Crouch writes about the early life of Charlie Parker, Bird, in his new book, Kansas City Lightning. Of course, he and Dizzy Gillespie put together a little sound called Bebop. We'll talk about that. Salt Peanuts behind us right here, 1945, June, Town Hall, New York City. Listeners, you can join us. What about Charlie Parker? What about Bird, his sound, his origins? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts. 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 Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Bird, jazz great Charlie Parker, and his rise out of Kansas City. Stanley Crouch writes up Bird, the early years, in his big new book, Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Stanley Crouch, big, big figure in his own right, jazz writer, cultural critic, and riffing here at great depth and breadth and length on early Charlie Parker. You can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, Ornithology behind us, Charlie Parker's Septet, 1946, Miles Davis in there, drummer Roy Porter in there. What a fantastic sound. Stanley Crouch, lots of response for you. Dremelard writes to us online. He says, Charlie Parker was a true creative and musical genius. Put him in the same league as Mozart and Chopin. Created new musical forms that quickly became part of our most valued musical heritage, influencing everything that came later. His virtuosity makes impossibly complex musical ideas sound perfectly beautiful and always came straight from his soul. That complexity that comes across as clear, how did he do that, Stanley?
Well, I mean, he put in many, many hours playing. See, part of what the book is about is it tells you that these guys worked against the idea that they were just natural players. You know, you get a bunch of these colored guys together and they can just get up on a bandstand and they can just make up things that sound good immediately. Well, that's not actually true. It's learned because they constantly played. They learned how to make an idea fit. They learned how to reconsider an idea. They learned how to follow another idea that was handed to them by one of the other players. They learned all of these things from playing all of the time, and they put in so much time that you could hear it sound almost as though it was written out. It was not written out. It was like the observation that a great Japanese painter made when he was about 90 years old, I think. Mm. And they asked him what he wanted to do now. He said, well, I have just mastered drawing a straight line. Right? So people think that that's kind of, that he was kind of making a joke. But if you try to draw a straight line on a piece of paper, a canvas in front of you, you'll find out it's not an easy thing to do. And so he had done that so long that he now could just go, and it'd be straight line, right? And that was the way Charlie Parker and all these people came to play, who were truly superior players. They played so often that they could make extremely good decisions very quickly.
Stanley Crouch writes about Bird. Charlie Parker said he needed pitches that came out of the horn quicker, that were as blunt as snapping fingers when the inspiration demanded. His tone was absolutely unorthodox, as much like a snare drum or bongo as a voice. It was assertive, at times comic, or cavalier, though often sweet. It could sound almost devoid of pity. One trumpeter thought it sounded like knives being thrown into the audience. He and Dizzy Gillespie, credited with giving birth to bebop. Here they are, 1945, Town Hall, New York City. That tempo, that harmony. Stanley Crouch, what made bebop bebop?
Well, basically it was the rhythm, actually. Mm. What I mean is the harmonies, Art Tatum had definitely played those already. Mm-hmm. So had Coleman Hawkins played them. But the rhythms that Charlie Parker brought to New York, Dizzy Gillespie told me once, he said, well, he said, Monk and I had put together all the harmony. We had all that. We had the bass line. We had figured that out. Kenny Clarke had figured out how to play the drums. He said, but we were still playing swing. He said, when Charlie Parker came to New York, with that phrasing he had, then everybody knew we have to go his way. That's what will make this something different. And that was what Charlie Parker was. He was a He was an amazing master of rhythm and could imagine phrases that were not being played that way until he started playing that way.
And Charlie Parker Byrd brought it on. Harold in Quincy, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Stanley Crouch. Thank you very much for joining us, Harold.
Thank you for having this show today. Byrd lives, Stanley. I had the pleasure of seeing Charlie Parker in 1953 at a club in Boston, the Hi-Hat Club. And I was 16 years old. They let you in underage for $2.50 as long as you drank Coca-Cola.
Okay.
I had started listening to jazz on the radio in 1950 with Symphony Sid was on our AM radio. And My Little Suede Shoes was a very catchy little tune, so we all went down to see Byrd. And after that, the spiritual part of his journey entered so deeply into me. I missed the early years, and I'm looking forward to this wonderful tome of yours. I have a 91-year-old friend, Art Howard. He would come up from Connecticut to go to the Savoy to see Jay McShann. He told me this story. And he was looking forward to hear Buster Smith, but Buster was not on the gig, but Byrd was. And that hit him unbelievably. So that was quite a journey for Art. He's one of my living historians, black men, that's lived through all of the segregation and the military during World War II. But I believe that Charlie Parker was a revolutionary in his musical endeavors. And subsequently, I just went for every record I could find, all the Savoys, all the Prestiges, those wonderful gigs that came out of the New York with Symphony Sid.
And you were there in 1953 at the Hi-Hat with a Coca-Cola. Incredible. Stanley Crouch, Harold says it. Everybody says that he was a revolutionary. Jeff writes to us, he transformed not just the saxophone, the entire idiom. You know, there's people saying here that his influence is pervasive in music today. What was it? What was the revolution? How do you define, describe that, Stanley?
Well, the revolution was that... Well, it was his phrasing first. Secondly, it was the way he could execute his ideas. Thirdly, he embodied a thing that, as Billy Eckstein makes clear in the book Kansas City Lightning, he and Dizzy and everybody else was greatly influenced by Duke Ellington, who actually was the one who got people to believe that they could go on a bandstand and be a certain kind of a guy and didn't have to submit to the minstrel dictates of the time. It would be like somebody today who was actually a talented rapper. I cannot imagine that, but if they were, who actually came out there in suits, he didn't feel like he had to look like some rough and tumble guy on the streets.
Yeah.
And so what I mean is, that to me is a continuation of the minstrel thing that people preferred to impose on jazz musicians at that time. Duke Ellington broke through it. Charlie Parker saw that. Dizzy Gillespie saw it. And all of these guys, they actually wanted to be the way Ellington was. They wanted to present something that was very beautiful, very powerful, very well played, and they didn't want to be minstrels at the same time. Charlie Parker.
Yeah, you're right,
embodied
about
that.
He did indeed, and you write about the musicians of his time, and I can hear this so clearly in his music, creating a new experience of time, a kind of control of the present. That is a big idea. You can hear it. I love this track, Coco, 1948. This is Royal Roost in New York City. Charlie Parker Quintet, Miles Davis in there, drummer Mac Roach. You'll hear Miles Davis here, then Charlie Parker, Coco. Davis and Charlie Parker, Stanley Crouch just having their way with time there, owning it, controlling it, as you say.
Yeah, well, see, the first thing you notice about that is how much more relaxed Charlie Parker sounds at that tempo than the trumpet sounds.
Yeah.
Because he could actually hear so well that he could take his time at that velocity because by then he could play the saxophone so well. Like Charles McPherson pointed this out to me. He said, look, he said the saxophone that Charlie Parker was playing did not have what they call an octave key that allows you to play an octave above where you start a phrase, right?
Mm-hmm.
He said Charlie Parker could actually make the saxophone do that. even though it was supposedly impossible,
yeah.
He could make things come out of the saxophone because he heard them. And so what I mean is Charlie Parker was an adventurous guy who had the same thing that I once described Jack Johnson as having for Ken Burns' film about Jack Johnson. These kind of people come out of American life because they all share one thing. They're dreamers, and they can bring off what they dream if they're as big as the dream itself. Charlie Parker was that big. And so the things he dreamed on the saxophone, he could convert other people to believe them as much as he did. You know.
And he did. We've got a call right here from Kansas City. Mark is on the line. Mark, you're on the air with Stanley Crouch. Thanks for calling from Kansas City, no less.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Wonderful.
Well, my understanding has always been that Charlie Parker sort of disavowed Kansas City after he went to New York and became bigger. In fact, didn't really even like to talk about his Kansas City roots. And I was just wondering why that is.
Well, you know, I'm not sure of that because I was talking with the great arranger Gil Evans once at the Village Vanguard, and he told me about being at a bar where both Charlie Parker and Lester Young came in one night at the same time, and they spent all the time in the bar just talking about how wonderful a city for a jazz musician Kansas City was. So I'm not sure that Charlie Parker actually disdained his relationship to Kansas City because Gil Evans wasn't a guy who exaggerated stuff. So what I mean is he was a very clear guy. And the way he described Lester Young and Charlie Parker reveling about their memories of Kansas City makes me disbelieve that he disavowed Kansas City. But he could have been in the mood on some day and said something.
Yeah.
As we now know about interviews in media, they aren't always accurate. And they don't necessarily capture the way you really feel about something.
One comment does not a whole outlook make.
Yeah, because Charlie Parker loved Buster Smith so much, loved Lester Young so much, loved jamming in Kansas City, loved the fact that he could play around the clock. He liked all of that. And so to get to New York and then say he didn't care about Kansas City or Kansas City wasn't a big influence on him, that's a bunch of garbage.
1954, it gets close to the end of his life. He's one more little bit here, him talking with WHDH in Boston, John McClellan and Paul Desmond, talking about his style, his way of playing the sax, how he developed it.
That's my first conception, man. That's the way I thought it should go, and I still do. I mean, of course, it could stand much improvement. Most likely in another 25 or maybe 50 years, some youngster will come along and take the style and really do something with it, you know? But, I mean, ever since I've ever heard music, I thought it should be very clean, very precise, as clean as possible anyway, you know? And more or less to the people, you know, something they could understand, something that was beautiful.
Charlie Parker, 1954. Stanley Crouch, you've been very critical of a lot of music that followed Charlie Parker, certainly lately. There, he's anticipating somebody who picks up his mantle, that style, and really does something with it. Have you heard that, Stanley?
Well, I heard it,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't to me. It wasn't, first thing, I haven't heard anybody since Charlie Parker who could play as well as he did. I have not heard that. I mean, if you took people like Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, and you combined all three of them, you would have one person who had almost the same level of talent that Charlie Parker did. Secondarily, I haven't heard anybody who's figured out a way of phrasing that fits with the rhythm section and swings another way. I've heard things that don't swing at all, and people act as though swing is like an imposition upon them. But that wasn't an imposition on Charlie Parker, so I haven't heard it. It might still be coming.
You've got another volume still coming. How long do we have to wait for this one, Stanley? The next?
Well, 2 or 3 years. That's about it. I'm not taking 32 years again.
Listen, we are so glad that you put in the time and put your mind to work on this one. I'm right there with Dwight Gardner. I'm ready to put your book on along with some Charlie Parker and hit the highway on audio late at night. Wonderful, wonderful read. Unbelievable music. Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker by Stanley Crouch. Stanley, thank you so much for joining us from New York today. Thanks for the book. Thanks for your insights.
Thank you very much for having me.
Just wonderful. Go out with Warming Up a Riff, Charlie Parker, 1945. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us today.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.